This is case 47 from the Mumonkan. Tosotsu's three barriers. The case. Master Jusetsu of Tosotsu made three barriers to test his monks, students. To inquire after the truth, groping your way through the underbrush, is for the purpose of seeing into your true nature. Here, now, where is your true nature, venerable monks? If you realize your own nature, you certainly are free from life and death. When your eyes are closed, how can you be free from life and death? If you are free from life and death, you know where you will go. When the four elements are decomposed, where do you go? Mumon's commentary. If you can give the three turning words about these three barriers, you will be the master wherever you may be and live up to the Dharma no matter how varied the circumstances. If you have not yet reached this stage, gulping down your food will fill you up quickly, while chewing it well will keep hunger away. Mumon's verse. This one instant, as it is an infinite number of kalpas. An infinite number of kalpas are at the same time this one instant. If you see into this fact, the true self which is seeing has been seen through. So before diving into this koan, I'd like to connect what's going on in Sesshin to something I said at the opening talk, about cultivating patience, unconditional, endless patience. So I'd like to connect that to making mistakes. It's not only okay to make mistakes, it's necessary. It's necessary to make mistakes. How can we learn anything, if we don't give ourselves the opportunity, the leeway, the freedom? Well, not just ourselves, each other, the freedom to make mistakes. Why do we become so uptight when we make mistakes? And what does that do to our action? We're so afraid of making a mistake that fear by itself produces more of what we are afraid of. It robs us of our attention. So in terms of being patient, right? Being patient with ourselves, being kind when we make a mistake. It's how we learn. And we can all learn. So the one who has made a mistake can learn to not make a big deal out of it, right? And pay attention, learn. And the others who may be annoyed by the mistake can also learn to be patient, to be kind, to be yielding. So why is it that we get so upset? We have to ask, what are we afraid of? What do we want? What is it that we think we will not get or will be taken away from us when we make a mistake? There's fear in the background. fear of being rejected, fear of not being loved, not being cared about, disappointing others, disappointing ourselves. Right? This comes up naturally, easily, or easily discovered. But we have to look further. What's behind it? Who's behind it? No, we practice also no trace, which works very well with that, right? Because when we make a mistake and we look at it, examine what just happened and learn from it, and then release, we don't leave a trace. In fact, we use it well by examining what just happened. Okay, great, I learned something. It's a teacher, right? So essentially, we end up rejecting a teacher by not wanting to make mistakes. Right? So we can learn something from that, release, move on. If we don't do that, we leave a trace. On the other hand, also, when we don't care about making mistakes, when we don't care about learning, we also leave a trace. So either way, we're not following the practice. We're following something else, someone else, which the practice is there to expose. So ask yourself that. Next time either you're the one who has made or making a mistake, or you see somebody else making a mistake, ask yourself, well, even if you're annoyed, ask yourself, how can I allow for that? How can I expand enough to allow for that too? So if you see it, if you witness it, just bear witness. That's it. Stay still, stay alert, stay connected, grounded. You don't have to allow the mind to express itself, right? The thoughts. Yeah, there are thoughts, judging, commenting, but that's okay. They could be there. They can coexist. So work with that. It's a very important nugget for our practice, nourishment for our practice. So some of you are not a part of our Sangha, and before I get into this koan, or the reason why I brought up this koan today, is because we are now in 3 months Angho period. In each Angho, we choose a different theme to work on. This one, the theme is impermanence. So this was the catalyst for bringing up this particular koan. So how is this session going so far for us? What do you bump into when you spend so many hours in silence and stillness? How do you meet the challenges and hindrances that arise in the body and the mind? And there are plenty, right? When we get quiet, the sediment, all kinds of stuff starts to float to the surface. All those things we work very hard to suppress or look away from begin to flow to the surface. What does it do to us? How do we meet it? How do we practice at Sesshin? What do we do with this opportunity? There are many ways to be at Sesshin. Right? We could shift to a survival mode and just get through the experience. Through grit, we can become deeply engaged with thoughts and fantasies and spend our time that way. Or we could sit here and make future plans for next week, next month, next year. We can get busy building all kinds of displacement mental constructs and escape meeting the rawness of what we experience. So those are all common options that we know on a personal level. We can do that, or we can trust that we are fully capable to meet whatever arises in each moment, whether it's physical, emotional, mental. We have what it takes, and we can bear witness to the challenges without looking for an escape route, and practice yielding and softening. Somewhere along the path of life, we lost touch with our intrinsic ability to be born, to live, and to die. From a deep place of surrender. We have it in us. We just lost touch with it. And Sesshin can be a wonderful opportunity to reconnect with that. Challenges are not new, right? From the moment we are born and take the first breath until the moment of our last exhalation, we meet all kinds of challenges and changes with varying degrees of complexities. It all begins with getting through the birth canal, right, begins with that traumatic experience. Coming through the birth canal and the drastic change from complete darkness to bright light. Moving from the comforting protection of the warm womb to a foreign environment full of commotion and loud noises. We were there. Somehow we knew how to deal with that. And then the challenges continue to naturally manifest through the first stages of our development, a succession of new experiences and barriers that somehow we seem to know how to merge with in the most direct way without knowing that we do that. Somehow the innate wisdom and the intelligence of our intrinsic nature knows how to employ awareness along with the senses, so it can express itself through this physical body, through this being. What state of mind is that? Who is that, we can ask? Or who was that? We all did it. In the commentary to another koan, it says, although a newborn baby is equipped with the six senses, though his eyes can see and his ears can hear, he doesn't yet discriminate among the six sense objects. At this time, he knows nothing of good and evil, long or short, right and wrong, gain or loss. A person who studies the path must become again like an infant. Then praise and blame, success and fame, unfavorable circumstances and favorable environments, none of this can move him. None of this can move him. Though his eyes see form, he is the same as a blind man. Though his ears hear sound, he is the same as a deaf man. He is like a fool, like an idiot. His mind is motionless like Mansumeru. This is the place where we can really and truly acquire power. This is why it is said in our practice that the purpose of practice is to become an idiot. Through and through, an idiot. Become a fool. not the fool that you know through thought. The fool that you were when you were born. Before anybody said anything that you were able to comprehend and concoct some ideas from. Then, what kind of a fool is that? Though his eyes see form, he's the same as blind. Of course, we see. But that discriminating consciousness is nothing but a tool for us to function, to use, to navigate through life, and not to make anything off. And the Sesshin offers optimal conditions to train ourselves to become an idiot again. Everything is done, everything is provided. You hear the gong, stand up. You hear this, sit down. Time to eat, go eat. Time to wash your balls, wash your balls. Time to sleep, sleep. It's a form of training. Now, if we just get through the experience and then go home and tell about it, we're not doing it. We're not training. We're just waiting for it to be over. So be careful. Watch the way you absorb it, what you do with it. So this idiot state of being is considered a source of true spiritual power because intellectual reasoning and emotional interpretations do not command our attention. And that liberates the provisional self to act from being in alignment with the source. It frees us to be in alignment with the source. Or in other words, the eternal can manifest itself through the ephemeral, a merging, a true merging of the conventional truth and the absolute truth. Huang Po said, Buddhas and beings share the same identical mind. It's like space. It doesn't contain anything and isn't affected by anything. When the great wheel of the sun rises and light fills the whole world, space doesn't become brighter. When the sun sets and the darkness fills the whole world, space does not become darker. The states of light and darkness alternate and succeed one another, while the nature of space is vast and unchanging, changeless. The states of light and darkness alternate and succeed one another, while the nature of space is vast and changeless. So we can take that line and we can say that we are born and we die within that. So the light, you can see that as a being is born, darkness, a being dies. Life and death continuously within this unchanging vastness. And it's not two. It's the unchanging vastness that gives rise to birth and to death. Or it's the unchanging vastness that shows up as birth and death. Then he said, the mind of Buddhas and beings is like that. The reason the Buddha said we practice to save all beings is only to help us get rid of the delusion of liberation so that we can see into our true nature And when we see into our true nature, who is saving who and from what? So what are we protecting? Why are we so uptight? Why are we not lovingly expressing ourselves all the time? What is holding us back? It's not the vast spaciousness. Then what is it? And it's not who we are that holds us back. What is true nature? Why is it so crucial to dive into this inquiry? You know, as spiritual practitioners, we were drawn to the practice. It's not random. It's not just by chance. We were drawn to practice due to a nagging inner impulse, which somehow recognized that there is a fundamental flaw in the way we live our lives as human beings. A deep-seated sense of discontentment and misalignment that seems to remain in the background no matter how hard we try to quench this yearning, longing. We never truly feel at ease and at home. We only get short-lived glimpses of it, but they don't last. As in one of my favorite quotes from Hafiz, first, the fish needs to realize that there is something wrong with this camel ride. And then, why am I so damn thirsty? Right? And it's a very powerful image because it is pointing at what brings us to practice. I mean, we have to honor it. It's not enough, right? Because, yeah, we may show up, which is great. But that's just first step. We have to keep nurturing this yearning, right? And then allow it to guide us. So we can maintain strong resolve, no matter what happens. Even when we get discouraged about practice, about ourselves, about where we get with it, still, we have to turn inwardly and again find that which brought us into practice in the first place. Because we know what it feels like. We know this longing to be at home, to be at ease. Who doesn't feel this way? Everybody does. Some are better than others in covering it up. But everybody does. So we all know this feeling. But what are we doing about finding our way back home and aligning with who we really are? That's the question the practice is asking us. In the commentary to this koan, Tsubayama writes, most people give themselves up to the pressure of temporal affairs and blindly pass through their days and nights. On some occasions, however, one may reflect on the ever-changing pictures of human life. He will realize the inevitable limitations and restrictions of everyday living. Once she realizes this actual human situation, she can no longer be indifferent about it, but feels an urge to solve this fundamental problem. She has to see into her true nature at any cost. Is this how we practice? Right? He's saying something very important. She has to see into this at any cost. I don't think many of us practice in this way. We do it, but then it subsides. And then we do it again, it subsides. Because something else takes our attention. But what about that question? And what about the fact that the time to deal with that question swiftly passes by? And the opportunity to break through will be lost, is lost. Does that matter? This is the burning question of our lives, which is brought up in this koan as three questions Master Tosotsu posed to his followers. He said to inquire after the truth, groping your way through the underbrush, is for the purpose of seeing into your true nature. So groping your way through the underbrush, isn't that what we experience in Sishin? Right? You turn inwardly in all kinds of underbrush and entanglements shows up. We grope through that, trying to find our way. And life itself, right? Everyday life often does feel like that. But when it's done for the purpose of seeing through our true nature, it's different. Then he said, here, now, where is your nature? Venerable Zen practitioners, if you realize your own nature, you certainly are free from life and death. So who are you right now? Putting aside all thought-based self-definitions, education, accomplishments, everything, what other people think about you, the karma you have to deal with, putting all of it aside and not groping to find some lifeless explanation for your existence. What is the experience of the one sitting on this cushion? What is the dynamic experience of the one sitting on the cushion? How do you answer that? Because when you speak about an experience, it's not the experience anymore. Right? You step outside of the experience to point at it and then describe it. But what about not stepping outside of the experience and bringing the question into the experience? Then what happens to the question? So that's his first question. Then he said, when your eyes are closed, how can you be free from life and death? If you are free from life and death, you know where you will go. So what happens when we die? When the eyes closed for the last time? Our entire life revolves around the grasping and attaching to our fictitious self, which is no more than a fixed idea in a constantly changing reality. Then one day, it suddenly changes from being animate to being an empty shell. What changes into what? We think we know, or we think we can explain. Or we may not want to explain. We may prefer avoiding it. But what changes into what? And the third one, when the four elements are decomposed, where do you go? When this empty shell completely disintegrates and merges with the soil, who are you then? These are the most common questions human beings have wrestled with for thousands of years. And they all have, these questions have direct, or one question, direct and immediate implications on every aspect of our lives. Immediate implications. Even if we choose to avoid, it doesn't really matter. We look at it or we don't look at it. Either way, right? Embracing or avoiding will directly impact the way we live our lives. There's nothing Zen about this. Right? It's not, well, I don't practice Zen, so I don't have to think about impermanence. I practice grasping. It's my kind of practice. Right? So it impacts everything, especially on the level of harm we inflict on one another. And facing these questions head on can lead us to being in the world as a force of goodness. Avoiding them will result in actions that will cause much harm to ourselves, to others. Easy to find proof for that, right? Just take the gun violence, the level of rising gun violence in our country. What's scary about it is that we have become so numb about it. Oh yeah, another mass shooting. What's for dinner? Is that how we view human life? I mean, how can we be so numb to a point of, yeah, okay, I'm going to move on. Does it resonate? Or we just got so desensitized because it keeps happening? But it is saying something. It is teaching us something. Or at least it's teaching how urgent this grave matter is. It's not just rising gun violence, it's also rising discrimination and rejection of those who may appear different from us. So it's, see what, you read the news, you see what's happening in this country. It's happening. It's not just that we're not loving or cultivating loving kindness, we are cultivating intense hatred. So it's a teacher for us, right? It's showing us something. The most vital examination of any spiritual practice has to be our fixed self-definition, because that's the culprit. That's the heart of all the harm we cause. The grave harm we cause to one another. And as soon as we step into an honest inquiry about who we are, the idea of the self as a fixed entity we grasp and defend begins to pixelate and lose its cohesive appearance. Everybody who is willing to turn to that and look at it will see what I'm fighting for does not exist. In fact, only the fight makes it exist. Without the fight, it does not exist at all. Rejection creates it. Discrimination sustains it. Most of us act as a fierce attorney working tirelessly to defend a client we never actually met. But we have to ask, who is this client we call self? Why do we become so reactive and defensive when it is under some scrutiny? What am I fighting for? And what will happen if I quit this exhausting job? You have to admit, it is exhausting. What if you don't react? What if somebody says something to you about you that you find offensive, that you find whatever, right? What happens if you don't react? Bring it on, you can say. I need this kind of practice. It helps me. Go ahead, blame me. Accuse me. Point a finger at me. I'll put my hands together and bow. Because I need this kind of practice. I need to be reminded. I need the pointer. We should become curious about this, right? What is it that I'm defending? Since it will fully collapse at the end of our last breath. It is collapsing. And even now it doesn't hold up. As hard as we try, it's not going to work. In the book, The Buddhist Teachings of Totality, Goma Sisi Chang writes, what we generally mean by the word self is, in the first place, a perpetual and unchanging identity. For instance, an applicant, Mr. Lee, was required to pass 3 successive examinations to secure a position in the firm. He passed the first examination on the first day and went to the firm again the second day. The examiner, upon seeing him, asked, "Are you Mr. Lee?" "Yes, I am," he replied. The examiner led him to take the second test. At this moment, there was a tacit understanding between the applicant and the examiner. They both considered the examinee to be the same person who had come the day before. He remained Mr. Lee. The person was not changed, and the identity was not changed. This unchanging and subsisting element is the first and most important constituent of the alleged self. A brief scrutiny, however, will immediately expose the fallacy of this belief. In 24 hours, so many things have been changed. Mr. Lee's eyebrows, fingernails, and so on are all slightly longer than they were the day before. He is one day older. His mental capacity and physical condition are both changed to a certain degree. Though the changes are very slight and insignificant from a practical point of view, nevertheless, it is a vast change from the viewpoint of, for example, a germ residing in his intestines. That's a good perspective, right? Because the only perspective we have, the only perspective we're interested in is our own perspective. We actually have the capacity to see different perspectives, it's just that we are not interested. Because our entire world is based on our perspective. So this is a lucid and undeniable description of the way we are, of what we are, which we may understand on intellectual level. Because it's true, right? It's just fact. Yet when it comes to our everyday life experiences, we often prefer to believe that until we die, this image of the self is unchanging. or at least we go along with the feeling or the feelings that seem to affirm that falsehood. And then there is Zazen, right? If we sit long enough and we are diligent in our practice, we do begin to experience the actual dropping away of all those mental constructs. And over time, even become a bit more comfortable with the sense of floating without parameters. Who are you then? We have to ask. When you search exhaustively for a fixed answer to this question, you will inevitably arrive at the conclusion that you do not know who you are. Because you won't find anything contained within any fixed parameters to refer to. And actually, that's much more who you are than you can ever imagine and conjure up through thoughts and emotions. That I cannot find myself, or I don't know who I am, is much more you than you can ever imagine. Because we can't know it in the way we want to know. It's the known that we protect. But the known is limited and made up. And we reduce ourselves, we really do, we reduce ourselves to a thought. To a thought. We are so much larger than that, but we just crawl into this tiny bubble. And we're afraid to step out of it. But stepping out is finding home. And as long as we protect ourselves, we fortify that shell, that bubble, then we're not going to experience outside of that. Because we keep fortifying that illusion. So in Zazen, we do get glimpses of that. We do experience that. But then Zazen ends, right? So will Sesshin. Now we're back to a bunch of provisional selves interacting with each other, experiencing very different circumstances through a unique, one-of-a-kind being. And this is also true. There is that truth as well. People ask sometimes, yeah, in my practice I can experience some level of integration or at-one-ment. And it's incredible, it's powerful, it's amazing. But then there's homework, traffic. Right? What do we do with that? You know, Zen practice can be misunderstood as if it is leading to a state of aloofness, ignoring the mundane affairs of everyday life, and residing in some state of unity or emptiness. But it's not like that at all. Phrases such as eternal, unborn, undying, interdependent origination, or emptiness are not about homogenizing everything and everyone to one flavor. It only means that our unique individual expression and our unique lives are in constant flux and always interconnected. In constant flux means I cannot find myself. Or I can only find myself in constant flux. Then if I am in constant flux, then what is it that I'm defending? What is it that I'm afraid to lose? I'm losing it. Day by day. I'm not the one of yesterday. So I'm already losing what I don't want to lose. I am that by nature. Can that be your true and intrinsic nature? If we understand it in this way, then there is nothing to seek, nothing to protect, nothing to reject, and nothing to go beyond. Even when we are dealing with traffic, home circumstances, work challenges, or our own mortality. In the Shobo Genzo, his fascicle on life and death, Dogen, he said, because there is Buddha within living and dying, life and death do not exist. And in response, the following was said, because the Buddha did not exist within life and death, he was not infatuated with living and dying. He was not infatuated with living and dying. Anyone who wishes to be freed from life and death should clarify this principle. Should you seek for Buddha outside of living and dying, you are like the one who pointed his cart north and drove off to the south. Or like someone who faces south hoping to see the North Star. It would be you're piling up more and more causes of life and death while missing the path to liberation. Simply put, living and dying is what nirvana is, and there is nothing to despise in living and dying, nor anything to be wished for in nirvana. Is this disappointing? Or is it joyful to hear that? Does it free us when we hear these words? And he said, at this very time, there is a distinction that frees us right off from life and death. It is a mistake to think that we go from being alive to being dead. Being alive is a position at one moment in time. It already has its past and it will have its future. Therefore, within the Buddha Dharma, we say that life is beyond just the act of being born. Death is also a position at one moment in time, and it too has its past and its future. Accordingly, we say that death is beyond the act of just dying. In the time we call living, there is nothing except life. And at the time we call dying, there is nothing except death. Thus, when life comes, it is simply life. And when death comes, it is simply death. When facing up to them, do not say that you want to cling to one or push away the other. Everyone says that. Who doesn't say that? But the problem with that is if we reject death, we reject life. This living and dying is precisely what the treasured life of a Buddha is. If we hate life and want to throw it away, that is just our attempt to throw away the treasured life of Buddha. And if we go no further than this and clutch onto life and death, this too is our throwing away the treasured life of Buddha by limiting ourselves to superficial appearance of Buddha. When there is nothing we hate and nothing we cling to, then for the first time we enter the heart of Buddha. Nothing we hate, nothing we cling to. Go beyond preferences. And beyond is here. Nowhere else. So how do we understand that in relation to Tosotsu's third barrier? When the four elements are decomposed, where do you go? When this physical body and its unique expression completely disintegrates, unique one of a kind, never before, never again, completely disintegrates and merges with the soil. Who are you then? I thought about this in relation to my grandmother. When I was young, my parents had full-time jobs and I spent a lot of time with my grandmother. I think she was my first teacher. She was a very loving, accepting, and deeply caring person who had tremendous impact on my life. I don't think I would be where I am at if it wasn't for her. And she died many years ago. And by now, her body, I'm sure, completely disintegrated. So that aspect has merged. That aspect of her being. Yet her loving energy is a living companion in my life. It is alive and well. And her presence, her kind smile, are also alive and well. She was born, she lived 91 years, and she died. But what she expressed through this uniqueness of her 91 years is not confined, was never confined to her being born, living, and dying. What she expressed is alive and well, does not, cannot be born and cannot die. The living and dying allows it to be expressed. We're here just for a moment, for one moment. Yet we are timeless. How do we reconcile the two and realize that they are inseparable? This band, I don't know if you know this band, Iron and Wine, they have a song titled Our Endless Numbered Days. It's a good title. Our Endless Numbered Days. It's true. It's not this or that. It's our endless numbered days. Mumon's commentary, he said, if you can say three turning words about these three barriers, you will be the master wherever you may be and live up to the Dharma no matter how varied the circumstances. If you have not yet reached this stage, gulping down your food will fill you up quickly, while chewing up well will keep hunger away. How do we chew well? It's a very interesting analogy, right? Because when we eat quickly, we end up eating more, but it is not satisfying. When you actually take the time to chew well, you're nourishing the body much more, and you end up eating less, right? So it's a good analogy. But how do we chew well in terms of practice? Now, here, this session. In the book Awakening to the Tao, Liu Yiming wrote, this is 18th century Taoist adept, when alchemists cook medicine, first they must steady the furnace and set up the cauldron. The quality of the cauldron is firmness, whereby the medicine is contained. The quality of the furnace is flexibility, whereby the firing is operated. If the cauldron is not strong, the medicine is easily lost. If the furnace is not steady, the fire flies off at random. What I realized as I observed this is the Tao of refining body and mind. Firmness and of determination in cultivating the way is the cauldron. firmness of determination in cultivating the way is your cauldron, the great determination. Becoming stronger with perseverance, never turning back, even though foiled by 100 times. Being impenetrable, unwavering, this is setting up the cauldron. To not be foiled. That's setting up the cauldron, regulating it. Alert observation at all times is the furnace, working gradually, serenely, unpressured. I keep telling you, take it easy. Sit upright, but be at ease. Why be uptight? Serenely, unpressured, this is steadying the furnace. That's exactly what it is. You steady your practice. When the cauldron and furnace are stabilized properly, you burn away the acquired habits that have become compulsive over the course of personal history, thus bringing to light the original state of completeness, sweeping away all acquired pollutants. And then what's left is what's always there, what always has been there from the first, who you were, who you are, who you will be. Flowers comes to life. And this is a description of what we need to be doing on the cushion. Our Zazen is the great furnace that will, if we steady it, burn up the traces of harmful karma and will refine the ability to express inherent wisdom. So today, here, each period of Zazen and in between, work on steadying and stabilizing the firmness of your concentration. Gently and serenely, without pressure, maintain one-pointed, wholehearted, unwavering attention. That's chewing it well. Mumon's verse. He says, this one instant as it is an infinite number of kalpas. An infinite number of kalpas are at the same time this one instant. If you see into this fact, your true self, which is seeing, has been seen through. One moment, 10,000 years. This is the, if you remember the opening talk, I mentioned the blank canvas that's always blank, even when we scribble all kinds of things on it, dump stuff on it. It remains blank. Shishuang said, cease, stop, have one thought for 10,000 years. One thought for 10,000 years. Be a cold ash, decayed tree, a strip of white silk without words upon it. That's the canvas. Be a strip of white silk. Because you are. Don't forget that you are that. One thought for 10,000 years. We can do that. But it takes great deal of attention, great deal of determination. And we're all here to support each other, to do exactly that. This whole place was built for that. So if we come up here, get through the experience and go back home without really diving into what matters, then we're not honoring this place. We're also not honoring ourselves. So please, don't squander this. Thank you.